Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. You can find information on this specific subtype or your subtype, as well as all our podcast episodes on SFA's website, www.curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Thanks for listening. In this episode, we hear from Susie Donahue, a uterine leiomyosarcoma survivor. We talk about navigating a new diagnosis, what exactly a sarcoma center is, and the decision to disclose or not disclose a sarcoma diagnosis in the workplace. We're so appreciative to Susie for sharing her perspective. Let's take a listen. Welcome to the Sarcoma Stories podcast. I'm Tasha, one of your hosts. I am the program manager of engagement and advocacy at SFA and also a rhabdomyosarcoma survivor.
And hi, everybody. I'm Brandi Felser, and I am the CEO at SFA. Today, we have a very special guest on our podcast. Susie, do you want to introduce yourself?
Well, thank you so much for having me here, Tasha and Brandi. My name is Susie, Susie Donahue. I am from Chicago. I'm 54 years old. And I am a 5-year survivor of uterine leiomyosarcoma.
I think it was earlier this year that you hit the 5-year mark.
Yeah, January 14th. So I'm coming up on 6 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. Congratulations. That's fantastic to hear.
So, well, thank you so much. It's just an honor to be here and to see you both and to get to talk about my journey. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And we're excited to talk about your journey. And so just to get started a little bit, do you want to talk just briefly, because I know there are some interesting things that I want to talk to you about that relate to your journey. But can you just give an overall summary of your journey with sarcoma?
Sure. Okay. So as I said, I'm almost a 6-year survivor. So I was diagnosed with uterine leiomyosarcoma on January 16th of 2019, following a hysterectomy to treat what we thought was fibroids. It was not a fibroid. Well, it was a massive tumor that 2 days later we found out was uterine leiomyosarcoma. And the way that is treated, we can go into this later too, but basically surgical resection with wide margins is the treatment for that. And when I was staged, I was stage 1B. It hadn't metastasized at that point. So I was treated with surgery was the primary treatment at that point.
And, you know, something that I saw was that when you were going into surgery, your doctor actually discussed with you that it could possibly be a rare type of sarcoma, which honestly, we don't hear that very much when we talk to people of their doctor or anyone even knowing that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was something that I think she brought it up or I brought it up, but the use of a morcellator. I had read an article, my sister Anne gave me an article 20 years ago about uterine tumors and morcellators and how just the outcomes were just horrific when this tool was used. So 20 years later, I'm back in her office and we're talking and I said, I know it's probably just a fibroid, but on the off chance that it's not, do you use morcellators? And she said, no. In this case, even though it's like a 1 in a million chance that it is a sarcoma, I'm just going to remove it entirely with wide margins. She said, myself and my colleagues here in this practice, we don't use them. And I was relieved. And I said, you know, it's funny, but 20 years ago, my sister gave me this article and I just couldn't forget about it. And she's like, don't worry, you know, it's so rare, but, you know, just in the off chance that it might be, we're really, we take it with wide margins. We remove it in one piece and we just treat it as if it is cancer. And she said, but, you know, the odds are, it's so rare. It's so rare. So don't worry about it. You know, I've got you. We're good. So I said, great. Then we scheduled the hysterectomy. That was December 23rd. And the first date that she had available was January 14th. So just a couple weeks later. And she said, let's do a hysterectomy. And I said, great, let's just do it. I was 48 at the time. And I said, that would give me peace of mind. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, that is, again, amazing that your doctor, even if she thought it's one in a million, the fact that she did that was fantastic for you and changed your journey. And it much different journey than many people who are diagnosed with sarcoma, who find themselves going to doctors over and over who don't even know sarcoma exists. So good for her that she even thought to do that.
I am just so grateful for her. Yeah.
Yeah, that phrase, it's so rare, don't worry, is something I think a lot of sarcoma patients have heard. But then the follow-up to, it's so rare, don't worry, but just in case, like, good on your doctor for thinking the just in case, because oftentimes it's so rare, don't worry, and let's move on. But that just in case piece is so important.
Well, this particular physician, we have a tradition in our family that started with her. Actually, 22 years ago, she delivered my son following a really traumatic birth. He had a diagnosis called craniosynostosis, where the sutures of his skull were fused together in utero. We didn't know that, but he was unable to pass through the birth canal. And she performed an emergency C-section, very complicated. She was able to get him out. He survived. And that we celebrated her and the surgeon that corrected my son's sutures. But on June 7th every year, we have Hero Day. So for 20 years leading up to me going back to see her for the concerns about my uterus, we had talked about this doctor and how she changed our life. And she allowed this child to come into the world, and he had no brain damage at all. He survived the delivery. And we celebrated her every year for 20 years. So when I went back to see her, I hadn't seen her in 20 years. I went back to see her with this new concern. I said, you know, just so you know, you're already a hero in our family. So whatever you can do to help me, you're already a hero in our eyes. So when she got the tumor out intact with wide margins, she's like, oh my gosh, she just changed our life. Again, and we worked together. We worked at the same hospital. So every time I would see her in the cafeteria, I would just tear up. I would just come over, give her a big hug and say thank you. So I've been able to thank her a few times since this has happened. But her knowing that it could be this rare tumor and treating it as if it was, I believe, definitely changed the course of my sarcoma journey.
And I like the way you phrase that. It could be, and she treated it like it was, instead of defaulting and thinking, as Natasha said, it's a one in a million. It's so rare. It's so rare. Instead saying, I'm going to, just in case, let's just be safe about this. So yeah, that's a good story. That's a good one. I mean, if there ever is a good one when you're diagnosed with sarcoma, that's one of the more positive and one that provides a little bit more hope, I think, as we all know the challenges that we have with diagnosis. But speaking of diagnosis, now you've gone through the surgery, and what was the follow-up from that? Any follow-up treatment? Any follow-up that you had to go through?
So I had the surgery. I was still in the hospital 2 days later when the pathology came back. So she came to my bedside and she said, boy, I did not expect this, but I am so sorry. It is leiomyosarcoma sarcoma. And she said, I got a plan. We're going to send you, you know, nobody at this hospital, who is a community hospital, has ever seen this before, but we know someone at a local hospital who has seen it before. So a week later, I did a follow-up appointment at a community hospital with an oncologist, gynecologist. So he was a gynecological surgeon that specialized in oncology, but he wasn't an oncologist. And I had a follow-up with him, and I had so many questions because I'm a researcher by trade. I'm a physical therapist, and I was in graduate school doing my doctorate at the time. And so, of course, I went on PubMed and EBSCOhost, and within a week had read every article that I could find on uterine LMS. So when I went in to meet with him, every question that I posed, he was like, I don't know. And I said, what are the clinical trials? Are there any other surgeries that you recommend? What do you think about aromatase inhibitors? And he just said, don't worry about it. You're going to be okay. And I said, okay, well, that's not the information I was looking for. I need some. I hired a cancer navigator, and that's what led me to my next stop on the journey, which was a sarcoma center.
So let's pause for a sec before we get to the sarcoma center, because this idea of the cancer navigator is really interesting. How did you think to do that? How did you find one? How can others find one? And what did this person help you do?
Great. So my sister-in-law is a grant writer for Children's Hospital out in LA, and she had met a woman at a fundraiser, and that was her job for a major children's institution in California. So she helped families of children through the process and find the resources they needed. So when my sister-in-law found out that I was ill, she just reached out to her and she said, I know you typically just work with kids, but is there any way you could help my sister-in-law? And she volunteered her services. So I say I hired a cancer navigator, but she actually did this pro bono for me. And we set up just a phone interview, and we talked about everything. And I don't know if I sent her my slides. I think I did. I sent her my pathology slides, and she met with her team out there at that hospital. And within a week of me calling her, she tracked down this sarcoma specialist at the hospital here in Chicago where I'm seen. She phoned him on his personal cell phone. He still doesn't know how she got that number. And she set up an appointment for me. At the time, I think he was overseas in Africa giving a presentation. And he said his phone just rang, and this woman was on the other line demanding that this person in Chicago be seen. And when I met him, he was kind of scared of me. He's like, who are you? And why was this woman so aggressive? And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm just a normal person. I'm sorry if she was assertive in getting this appointment for me. But she was on it. And she phoned him and she said, you need to see this woman next week. He came in on his day off. And we met. We didn't even meet at the hospital. We met at a different location because he didn't have clinic hours at the hospital that day. But he saw me and he took my slides and he took them to the tumor board. And but she was the one that set all that up for me,
which was amazing. And I'm so grateful for her.
I don't know if it's a field of practice, cancer navigators. It should be. It was so, so helpful for me. She's one of our heroes, too. She's on our hero cake every year.
I think there are so many pieces of that hit for me, both as a cancer survivor and someone who's needed to navigate cancer treatment, and also someone who now works for a patient advocacy organization. Because even if a cancer navigator isn't, and I just used quotation marks for listeners, even if that is not a field, or maybe it is, I also have to look into that. There are so many pieces of that that you do need when navigating a diagnosis. And for me, it was words like assertive, advocacy, and you kind of become a cancer navigator in yourself as a patient. And those are two qualities that resonate with me of, yeah, you need to learn how to be assertive, how to advocate to get the care you need. But for patients who are newly diagnosed and might not have a cancer navigator service available to them, what I started thinking about is, well, now there are patient advocacy networks and places that you can go for these resources to find the education you need to be assertive and advocate for yourself and be an informed participant in your care. So whether it's a resource or not, specifically a cancer navigator, there are so many resources available that can help you be your own cancer navigator now.
Oh, especially through the Sarcoma Foundation of America now. I mean, I didn't know about it prior to getting this diagnosis, but the resources that you have available now are so helpful. Like there's that booklet that a person can take in to their first appointments and just even knowing that a sarcoma center exists. What is it? Right? How does a hospital qualify as a sarcoma center? And what does that mean for someone who is dealing with a rare diagnosis like sarcoma? Why is it important? And so all this I learned through the Sarcoma Foundation of America.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think when it comes to cancer navigation, I think most patients really connect to the navigators that the institutions may have available, but not all patients know that institutions have navigators available and not all institutions have navigators available. And then the navigator does many different things. It could be a financial navigator, it could be the social worker who's helping navigate. So there's a lot of different sort of ideas of a navigator. I know each year at our New York Gala, we honor with our Compassionate Care Award a navigator, someone who plays that role for people because we think it's such an important role. But I do think the concept of being able to get someone to work personally for you on your behalf outside of the institution is very important. And I know there are organizations out there that have sort of hotlines and things like that that you can call, but it's not the same as your experience of having someone who can personally look at your case and as detailed and make those phone calls. But also to your point, in terms of the sarcoma centers, it is important to understand what is a sarcoma center mean? SFA actually has criteria that sarcoma centers have to meet in order to be listed as a sarcoma center. And we periodically actually update that list and we send it out to sarcoma centers to make sure they still are fulfilling that criteria to be considered a sarcoma center. And so there'll be centers that are listed at SFA sometimes, and then sometimes they won't if they don't meet the criteria. And we also work with the Sarcoma Patient Group Advocacy Network in Europe for their European sarcoma networks that they manage very, very well. And we also recently published a paper on what a sarcoma center should look like. And that's really important. I only highlight that in this conversation, because I think you're right, Susie. It's important for patients to understand what does a sarcoma center mean, because there are centers out there that may call themselves a sarcoma center or sarcoma specialist that might not meet that standard. It doesn't mean they might not be fine doctors, but from a sarcoma perspective, at least SFA, there's a difference. And I'm glad that you were able to connect to that, because what we do know is not all doctors have those kind of conversations with their patients, especially in a community setting. And oftentimes you have to do your own research to find that out for people who are especially newly diagnosed. So I think that's a very important point that you raised there for sure. One thing I wanted to mention, you had said that your hero doctor worked with you at the same hospital. And I sort of wanted to get into the topic of work. We have talked to one other guest on this podcast series, and she spoke about working during her diagnosis and treatment. And I know you have spoken about that, working during your treatment. But what was that experience like for you? Because it can't be easy, but talk about your experience with working and how you managed and navigated a cancer diagnosis while still continuing to work.
Yes. So we did work at the same hospital. I'm a pediatric physical therapist, and I've been in practice for 30 years. So I knew going up to what I thought was the fibroid surgery, I had worked with my HR team to get 8 weeks off. So I knew that's just typical after an open abdominal procedure. So I knew I had 8 weeks off to recover. I didn't anticipate the cancer diagnosis. So when I phoned them back to say, oh, change of plan, they said, no, you still just get 8 weeks. I was like, oh, okay, okay. And I had to go back for a second surgery. I had to have my ovaries removed. I believe that was 3 weeks after my initial procedure. Once they found out that the tumor was estrogen positive, the team recommended that. So I did have to go back for that. So really, I came back to work 5 weeks after a second surgery. So I did get that 8 weeks off. But during that time, I had two major surgeries. I started aromatase inhibitors, which is a drug that, for me anyways, resulted in fatigue, pain. I had a PET scan, a CT scan, DEXA scans, lots of blood work. So a lot happened in those 8 weeks. And I was limited physically. My doctor wouldn't let me take more than 500 steps at a time. I wasn't allowed to lift at all. So to go from that state to then Monday morning, 8 weeks later, I'm expected to be a fully active mobile pediatric PT, lifting up to, 40, 50 pound children, climbing, running, squatting, jumping, running 8 to 9 hours a day. And so that did not work well. That was a really, really hard transition, and I couldn't do it. So I ended back up in my doctor's office that day to say, I can't do this. I'm so sorry. I do want to be a pediatric PT. I want to work for this hospital. I physically can't do it. So they gave me an extra 2 weeks to rehab my body and try to get back to the point where I could do all of this. So for me, with this rehab perspective of go, 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 you can do it. Come on. You just need to train harder and, you're recovered. Everything's fine. I didn't take the route that I would encourage my own patients to take. I just pushed through and got back to work right away and just pretended everything was okay. And it didn't actually work out really well because I ended up injuring myself. I broke my leg and had a third surgery then because, now I have this extra thing to deal with. So for me, having those three surgeries in such a short amount of time and not rehabbing my body the way I would encourage others to do it. If I had something to do over again, it would be that. I would take more time, I would rest, I would heal, and I would properly rehab myself before getting back to work.
Resonates with me as something as a almost a misconception about treatment, whether it's a surgery, chemo, radiation, whatever the treatment course might be. This is what I didn't understand until I became a patient, but just how much time is necessary for recovery. And I think about this as something in terms of advocacy as well. Not everyone has available to them the time to take to recover in a way we might want to. And I think about that a lot in the time frame you're giving 8 weeks, 2 weeks to recover from these major events is not often enough and not something everybody can take the time off to access. And I just think about that a lot for people who are in this position needing to recover and where some advocacy efforts can go towards supporting people who need to recover from cancer treatment, sarcoma or otherwise. It's so intense. And listening to you talk about that and this, the mindset of like, okay, I do really want to go back to work, but my body right now can't do that, just resonates with me quite a bit.
And Susie, how did you have those conversations with, or were you able to have those open conversations with people you worked with the leadership, people at work to say, this is what I'm going through and this is what's impacting me?
No, to be honest, I didn't have those conversations. I think in my field, we hide injuries. A lot of us have worked hurt. And I even hid the third surgery. They didn't know I had. Yeah, I had a piece of my femur had chipped off, and they had to go in and repair it. And it just worked out that week I was flying out because I was in graduate school at the time too. I was doing my doctorate in physical therapy, in pediatric physical therapy. So I was already a PT. I'd been practicing for 20 years, but I went back to pick up the doctoral part. So I had already arranged for that week away to be at my graduate school in Provo, Utah. So I arranged for the surgery to happen 3 days before flying out. So by the time I got back to work, I was just using a cane. I had a limp, but nobody asked. So I was able to get through my shift. And within a week after that, I was off the cane. And again, terrible advice for a patient. I would never, ever, ever tell a patient to go back to work before they're physically able. But my family was depending on the paycheck. I had no more PTO. And I was afraid that if they found out that I couldn't practice, that I'd be let go. And so I regret it, but I never did talk to my team. I mean, they could tell that I wasn't physically my best, but I was able to get the work done. I was able to provide the care to my patients and work full time and stay in school. And I just pounded away at it. It's not the way to go, though. I would encourage folks to talk to their leadership team, talk to their team, get those accommodations in place.
So many people find themselves in that same situation where, for various reasons, they don't have any options or they're afraid to talk about it. You know, we hear that a lot too, with people who just don't even like to talk, number one, that they even have a cancer diagnosis. That's first and foremost. But, you know, you're not alone in that. And I don't say that lightly. It's something that when we think about advocacy and patient advocacy is something that as a community, we need to change. But many people feel the same way you do and the same way you did and in the situation that you were in of, I need this job and I need the health insurance. And especially because I'm going through a cancer diagnosis, I can't lose my health insurance. I can't lose my job. So I have to figure out a way to make this work. And it's unfortunately, I think, the system that we function within and a system that we need to change.
I agree. It's, when health insurance is tied up with a job and you have a chronic illness or a new diagnosis, it's tricky. You can't lose that job. But if you do, and I did leave that job because I think it was a year and a half in, I just physically was not doing well. So I did take a break. And then 6 months later, when I had to apply for a new job, I scrubbed my LinkedIn account. There was no mention of sarcoma. I hid it. And now I'm living out in the open. I am not hiding who I am or what I've been through anymore. And so if and when I do apply for a new job, that'll just be part of the conversation. If it is, if it's not, great. But in my field, you do have to take a physical before before you get a new job. And it does add that extra layer of, gosh, will they not want me because of what I've been through? You know, it's unfortunate, but yeah, that is one of the things I've been dealing with.
Deeply resonates because I had lost my job during my recovery. And it was that exact thought of, will a job not want me because of this, would go through my brain all the time. And shout out to my social worker and my therapist, because we did a lot of work on how to talk about it in applying for jobs, if it was something I even wanted to talk about. And also a lot of time thinking about, in the year that I was in treatment, I like to put a lesson to everything just by who I am, but what were the skills I gained while I was in treatment and how could I bring that into a new role and talk about that in a new role? So that was something I spent a lot of time thinking about. And, you know, I'm sitting on this conversation now with my boss, who is so familiar with my story. So it's funny to talk about it now, but these were all things that, you know, I was thinking about constantly when returning to the workforce. But I'm curious, Susie, because I know now you're in between jobs, and if I'm not mistaken, you had another job after the one you left that you didn't disclose, but then you did disclose at another one afterwards, correct?
Yeah. So the job that I got afterwards, yeah, I didn't disclose. I was given the job. I did it for 2.5 years. It was a great job. I loved it. And I don't know when I, maybe a year into it. I remember what happened. I had a Zoom call with my oncologist. You know, after a 3-month cancer scan or a 3-month CT scan, he phoned me to deliver the news. And I was at work and I said, okay, you know, I took my computer into the other room and he gave me the results, which were great. And I just started crying because I was so relieved. And I walked out of the room and everyone kind of turned and looked at me. And I said, okay, so good news. And I said, okay, so this is what's going on. And I just told everybody. And it was a good thing that caused me to do that. I was just so relieved. And I just wanted to share it. I said, okay, you know, this is what I'm going through. And everyone said, oh my gosh, we had no idea. And I said, well, just, you know, kind of keep it confidential because I don't want it to affect anything. And then I was a traveling therapist for 2.5 years. So every week I was in a new clinic. So I would say the vast majority of the time, it never, ever, ever came up. But if it did, like I have my laptop, you can't really see it, but there's lots of decals on it. And there's a sarcoma one on there. And so if someone did see it, I'd be able to say, oh yeah, this is something that I've been through. Or I even put it in the company newsletter when I did the marathon last year for the Session of America. That was when I really came out as a survivor to corporate. And it didn't affect anything. They were just like, great, put it in the newsletter. Nobody said anything. They didn't question my skills. They didn't question my ability to do a very, very physical job. And I was just really grateful for that. So their non-response was actually super, super positive thing for me. And I was very relieved to see that. They're just like, great, you're running a marathon because you have sarcoma. Sounds good. Anyone wants to donate? Here you go. So for me, then that was probably a year ago. And then ever since then, I've been more vocal about it on LinkedIn and connecting with folks and sharing and liking posts and just letting people know that this is part of my journey and that's okay. So,
and telling everybody on a podcast.
Yeah, I suppose this is a first for me. I've never talked about it other than I did give at one of the Sarcoma Foundation of America does those 5Ks. Well, for us, it's in October, so fall in Chicago. But I was able to get up on stage and tell my story there. But that was just to, you know, I think there's 1,000 people there. So that's the most I've ever talked about it. But
I really want to talk about your participation in the marathon and the 5Ks. But I'm curious, having just closed at work, just to conclude that, what if there is someone listening to this who finds themselves in the position of wanting to just close at work, but are kind of fearful to take that step. What kind of advice would you give them? I know for me, it was the like thinking about the skill that I could bring to the table from my experience, but I'm curious as someone who's been in that position, what would you tell someone who's thinking about that?
Gosh, well, I guess it would come down to why. Why do you want to close? If you need accommodations, I think that would be an important reason. Know the law too, because I've always worked for bigger corporations, so I know the Americans with Disability provision has protected me, and I've been able to. I knew I would be able to keep my job, but did I really know? That's a tricky question. I guess I would ask, if you are going to disclose, know your why, know that what you want to accomplish with that, and then maybe talk to somebody just to make sure you are protected.
That's an important part that plays into it, but I think it's also important for people to know that there are resources for that too, to speak with before you disclose, so that you do know your rights and where you're protected.
Natasha, when you talk about the kind of the skills that you learn, you know, I'm sitting here thinking like from my manager's cap when you said that. And I'm thinking, yeah, when you think about the skills, I mean, resourcefulness, right? Because you're taking the initiative to learn about something that you knew nothing about. And the resourcefulness to say, I'm going to an initiative to take on and find your path forward and be able to be that active participant. And that's also leadership. It's strength. I mean, there's so many qualities that someone who is surviving sarcoma and going through the journey gain, or if we're home, right? It's either I've had these qualities, but now I have to kind of take them to another level. And so when you think about what do I bring to the table? There's a list of things that I bring to the table having gone through this journey. Hope that people listening understand that about themselves as well. This, I bring a lot of things, a lot of things. This journey has caused me to have to go through.
Yeah. I remember sitting down and making a list of my concerns. And one, you know, chemo brain is such a large topic of conversation when you've gone through chemotherapy. And I remember thinking, you know, what if I'm not as sharp as I used to be when I returned to work? And I was like, you know, I got so much better at multitasking, though, because I had to manage my symptoms, manage my meds, manage my care, manage my insurance, do all of these different things all at once. So I remember writing this list of here's my concern. How do I flip this and talk about it to a skill I've gained from this concern, and just created this list. I'd encourage anyone who is thinking about returning to work or how to talk about it in interviews to do that, because it was a good practice or exercise to do when interviewing, but it was also a confidence boost. It helped me take this situation that was, you know, horrific and be like, this is how I came out of it, and recognize some of the resilience in that. I'd love to circle back to the Marine Corps Marathon, which you just ran this past year. And after, you know, all of these surgeries, breaking your leg, ran the 10K, was it?
This year, just this past October, my husband and I did a 10K. But the year prior, I realized that the 10K was an option. I got an invite from somebody at the Sarcoma Foundation of America asking if there would be any patients who would be willing to participate in the marathon. I am not a runner. I'm a swimmer. I can swim for days, but I don't run. And so sounds great. And I signed up for it and I started to train, but I never actually trained on land. I actually only ran in the water, in the open sea, and in swimming pools. So that's how I did my marathon training. And two of my sisters came out to DC with me that weekend. And yeah, I ran in a marathon. I didn't finish it because my pace was too slow. And so after a certain point, they do cut you off, because I think you're only allowed 7 hours to run it. And I was below that pace. So I didn't finish it, but I gave it my best shot. So that was last year. And all of the fundraising that I did went to the Sarcoma Foundation of America. And so it just felt really good to do, to be out there representing SFA and letting folks know that even with a sarcoma diagnosis, you can run in a marathon. And the lady that the SFA had hired to mentor us, Jackie completed, she holds the world record for females consecutive marathons run in a, you know,
it was like 100 marathons in 100 days. Yeah. So you have held the world record. Yeah.
Okay. So she was, you guys hired her to be our coach and our mentor. And so that was such a gift to be able to meet with her online and knowing that she's a sarcoma survivor herself and she mentored us. So it was just a blast. So then this year, I signed up for the 10K, which I can do. So my husband and I flew out to DC recently, and the two of us did that together. And it was just so much fun. But just thank you for allowing us to be part of the team and to be able to help through our fundraising efforts. It was a gift.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, so all the fundraising through our marathons and our races go to fund the research that we fund every year. So it's really important for our mission and to advance, you know, sarcoma outcomes. But it's amazing that you signed up to do it, because it's intimidating.
it's, in, you know, when you think about, okay, I'll sign up for a marathon. What does that even mean? You know, like, all right, I'll do it. I'll get out there and try. And it's not an easy thing to do. Just getting to the sign up point is a big step. Not about whether you finish or not. It's the fact that you got out there, that you were brave enough to even step foot out there to even give it a try. There's a lot of people who wouldn't even want to try it. So good for you. And then to come back for the 10K. So that's amazing.
And we'll be back next year. So you should join us.
Yeah.
Or any of the listeners, sign up. We'll be part of a team together. The more the merrier. It is a really fun race, and it's a beautiful race through the streets of DC. Like, you're passing the Capitol and the Washington Monument, and it's a stunning course.
And it is a stunning course.
Really, really, really fun. So,
and it all about sarcoma. Because, you know, we get to have our own team out there, and we get to let people know that there are people out here running for sarcoma. And it's a great way to reach tens of thousands of people about sarcoma awareness.
I wrote this down because I love this quote that you just said: just because you have a sarcoma diagnosis doesn't mean you can't run in a marathon. And I love that you said in a marathon, because because it doesn't in the end matter if you finish it. If you set out a goal, you put yourself out there for something, and marathon could be anything to anyone. It doesn't have to be an actual 26.2 mile marathon. It could be learning how to walk again with a prosthetic, or, you know, learning, for me, it was learning how to eat again. That was a marathon. I was on a feeding tube during my treatment, and like, that was my putting myself out there at a time, and it evolves, right? So I love that whatever marathon is to our listeners, like, just because you have a sarcoma diagnosis doesn't mean you can't do X thing that you want to set for yourself and a goal out there for yourself. It doesn't have to be 26.2 miles, but I like that. That's going to be one of my mantras after this conversation.
Yeah, I'm very clear that I did not finish the marathon, but it doesn't matter. Was the funding? I got the funding. That is what encouraged me to come out at work and talk about my diagnosis. And, you know, two of my sisters, my beloved, I have a big family, and two of them flew out with me. And it just meant so much to me to know that they were there. They were, cheering me on at the sidelines. And it was a beautiful thing. So thank you for having a team every year. And hopefully we'll have a really huge team next year, because it's the 50th anniversary of the events.
Yeah. We are already recruiting for the team. So, yeah. And we also have people running in the New York City Half Marathon coming up as well in March.
And you also mentioned the 5K series, the Race to Cure Sarcoma. I know you have a team in Chicago, which is, you know, if a marathon or a half marathon or a 10K sounds intimidating, we also have these 5Ks that
are so much fun. They are so much fun. There's always music, and the top fundraisers, at least in Chicago, I think the top 10 fundraising teams get a tent that we can decorate. And then, of course, we fill it with food and to give to everybody else. It's like a party. It's so much fun. And in Chicago, my sarcoma team, they're on the course with us. So my physician and the PA and the nurses, they are there too. And so they're getting all the hugs, and it's just a big, beautiful love fest every year. And my whole family comes out for it. I've had friends fly in. One of our friends from Germany flies in every year to do this with us. And I've had my best friend flies down from Minnesota. And so it's just a chance to get together every year and just, you know, celebrate being alive. And
I'm so glad to hear you say those things, because that is so much why we do those races. And, you know, many people look at those fundraising events, which they are, again, they fund research, but it's also about bringing the community together and honoring our survivors, honoring those that we've lost, giving people who've lost someone a place to still continue to celebrate them and their life, and to connect with the medical professionals, but really a place to bring the sarcoma community together. And for us, from an SFA perspective, they mean so much more to us as an organization than just it's a 5K run. It is so much more than that. And what is behind it for us is so much more. and they're a really important part of what we do for the community. And just meeting the patients and hearing the stories, it also, you know, grounds us. We take where people put up the Wall of Hope and Remembrance, we take those pictures and we put them in our conference room. And we're able to remember why we do what we do. And they're really an amazing experience, even for us to go to and to be able to participate in. And I know the staff loves to be able to go and join those as just that connection, as a connection to the community and a connection to the people that we serve. So I loved hearing how you explained it, because that's exactly how we want people to feel and how we want people to see them and coming out as just to be together, just to be together, to know that you're not alone. And as you said, to celebrate that you're alive, to celebrate our survivors, and then remember that we're still working on behalf of others who are not here.
Yes, yes. And I, at the most recent one that I was at, the family of a man who had passed, I got to meet them and just hear, they could just talk about how brave he was and what he went through and as you said, celebrate him and his life. And every year, hopefully they'll come back. Their team, they had one of the biggest teams as a way to honor his memory.
Yeah, there's a gentleman that comes to the Chicago race that I met, and his wife passed away, gosh, it's probably 7 years now. And he comes every year just to honor her. And you know, it's nice to know that people, like, they still have the community. You're still welcome in our community. We're still here for you, and we're still working on behalf of your loved one.
Keeping those lives alive, in a way, keeping their memory alive and also celebrating life, and those two things together. And there's a place for all of it. And I think in a diagnosis that is fundamentally isolating because of its rarity, it's one place where you find so much community, whether you've lost someone or whether you are in it yourself and celebrating being alive or supporting someone, or you're a care partner who is looking for support. So many care partners, I think, find each other there as well as the patients do. And that was how I found SFA, was the 5K from my hospital bed as my muscles were atrophied during chemo. And I said, you know, if I'm walking and if I'm alive when this comes to Boston, I'll do it and I'll go. And that was that. So, yeah, what a great event and what an honor to have you as part of our Chicago community there.
Aw, thank you. Thank you. Oh, I can't wait for the next one. I'll be there.
Me too. I'm going to send my sister. She lives in Chicago.
Yeah,
she joined the team. She did it in 2023, but was traveling in 2024. Yeah, I'm going to send her to your team. So speaking of the community, Susie, what would be a message that you want to leave with listeners?
Oh, boy. Find a sarcoma center. Like if you're a patient or you're a care provider, for me, that was the best decision I ever made, was making sure I was at a center where this is all they think about all day long, every day, is sarcoma and how to care for those folks. And also take time for yourself to rest and recover and surround yourself with love and resources and reach out and ask for help. That's something I perhaps didn't do enough of, but in recent years, I have found that finding your community and just surrounding yourself with folks that love you and activities that bring you joy, that's where it's at for me. And that the big change happened for me when I just started living my life that way, living my life out in the open as a sarcoma survivor, and being open to everything that life has to offer.
One other question I have for you is, what resources did you find helpful in your journey, and would you recommend to other people who may be listening and who are, you know, searching for resources that might help them?
So first resource was the Sarcoma Foundation of America. Second resource was there are some Facebook groups. At my particular subtype, leiomyosarcoma sarcoma, I was able to find some Facebook groups of survivors. That was really helpful for me. And the being at a sarcoma center, they were able to direct me to other resources that I needed. I needed to see a dietitian. I needed physical therapy. I needed massage therapy because I one of the side effects for me was chronic pain. So those were some great resources for me. If you need clinical social work or you need to talk to a counselor, I would definitely advise finding someone that has experience with a chronic health conditions, pain, death and dying. That's who I matched with. And it was extremely helpful for me.
Who helped you find that connection? Because I do think there's a lot of people out there that would take advantage of that opportunity. Who helped you make that connection to that therapist or clinical social worker?
I think
was it through your, did you do it on your own or was it through the center?
Yeah, I did that on my own.
Okay.
They had therapists that I could work with. I used like someone who had experience with death and dying and philosophy of treatment gelled well with mine they weren't particularly close. I had to drive about 90 minutes each way to get to them, but it was worth it. So I know Psychology Today, that online, the magazine, like you can enter all the different things that you're looking for and they can match you with providers and also with, you know, who your insurance provides. Yeah, but that particular therapist I did find on my own. My sarcoma center did provide, I think I had a few sessions with their therapist and then their dietitian. They had all of that already in place, which is really helpful.
And did you have to ask when you're at your sarcoma center for any of those resources, or they just automatically offered? I'm asking because, you know, to a certain extent, I want patients to understand that some places may have that available. And if it's not offered, then ask. So I'm just wondering with your in particular situation, did you have to ask?
I think it came up because my tumor was estrogen receptor positive, which meant I'm vegetarian. So I think I said something like, am I able to eat soy? And that's when they said, that's a really good question. And they had a dietitian who was a sarcoma dietitian. So she knew everything about it. And so for me, I think I did ask about it. But they had it ready to go. And within 24 hours, I got a phone call from her.
Yeah. Well, great. So for people listening, if it's not offered to you, it's definitely worth asking forces that you think you might benefit from and seeing if they're available.
Susie, if listeners wanted to connect with you after this episode, and you mentioned Facebook groups, then I will plug that this podcast has a Facebook group. So we invite listeners and guests to join it, to connect afterwards or discuss episodes. But outside of that, if listeners wanted to connect with you, where would they find you?
Sure. Yeah. The easiest place would be Facebook. I'm Susie Donahue. I'm in Chicago. I don't think there's that many Susie Donahues, but there are a few in Chicago. So you could look for me there or Instagram or LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. And again, just Susie Donahue, if you look up Physical Therapist Plus Chicago, I will pop up.
Amazing, Susie. I know this has been an incredible conversation. I feel as a survivor, very seen by a lot of what you've said. So I just so appreciate you sharing and living your life out in the open, as you've said, and being a part of the SFA community. We're just so lucky to have you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was really nice to talk to you both today. I really appreciate it. And I'm so grateful to SFA and to you both and your whole team for doing what you do for us and working to fund and find a cure.
Thanks, Susie. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes.
If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.